Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations.
Hey everybody, welcome to today's Gaming Colloquium Talk. Today we are going to hear from Eddington Fellow, Massimo Leone of the University of Turin, who has a fascinating talk called Praying and Gambling. Massimo, it is all yours.
Good afternoon. First of all, let me thank the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the Center for Research on Gaming for this wonderful opportunity. I was really privileged to be an Eddington Fellow and be able to use the splendid special collections of the library. So different relations can obtain between praying and gambling. First of all, praying can be a gambling invocation. There is a Catholic saint, Gaetano da Thiene, 15th century, that is considered as the saint protector of gamblers, considered also as the saint of providence, perhaps also because his name, Tiene, in Italian means he has, he gets, or more probably because of his pastoral work with the lowlifes of Verona, where he established a bank to protect the poor and the gamblers from usury. It later became the Bank of Naples, one of the most important banks in Italy. Online, however, one can find prayers in Italian and in English to this Catholic saint that are meant to be addressed to him in order to achieve success in gambling. It might be useful in a city like Las Vegas. But, of course, it is an expression of popular religion that contradicts the usual theological stance of the Catholic Church against gambling and its social consequences. The second relation between prayer and gambling could be formulated as praying as a form of theological gambling. You are probably all familiar with Pascal's wager in the Pensée, Thought, part 3rd, paragraph 233. I quote the English translation by Trotter. Pascal would write, "God is or is not, but to which side shall we incline? Reason can decide nothing here. There is an infinite chaos which separated us. A game is being played at the extremity of this infinite distance where heads or tails will turn up. What will you wager?" And this is, of course, the famous theological argument by Pascal, later discussed in subsequent philosophy. But also in a book that I was lucky enough to read these days in the library, Gambling and Betting, a short study dealing with their origin and their relation to morality and religion, published by Charles Robert Henry in 1924. Charles Robert Henry was a biblical scholar and at the end of his life also Archdeacon of Westminster, a book that theologically condemns betting and gambling. However, Charles admits the anthropological universality of gambling and links it with divination. In chapter 2, The Universality of Gambling, he writes, I quote, "Gambling is closely allied with the methods of divination by means of which primitive man sought to learn the future." In the same book, he also refers to the fact that casting lots is often used as a way to determine the will of God in Judaism, and indeed, as Charles instead himself underlines, I quote, "The only explicit denunciation of gambling in the Old Testament occurs in Isaiah 65:11, quote unquote, preparing a table unto luck and offering a full libation of mixed wine unto fate." In Christianity, the replacement of Judas through a 12th apostle does not involve gambling, but does involve casting lots. You probably remember Acts 1:26, in which the way in which the new apostle Matthias is chosen is described. The passage goes, "And they gave forth their lots, and the lot fell upon Matthias, and he was numbered with the 11 apostles." So Judas was replaced by another 12th apostle who was actually chosen casting lots. Lot translates the Greek kleros, which also appears in the passages that in the four Gospels refer to the casting of lots at crucifixion. For instance, Matthew 27:35, I quote, "And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, they parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots," end of quote. The reference is to Psalms 22:18, I quote, "They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture." Here, lots translates the Hebrew goral, which means pebbles used for systematically making decisions. So both Judaism and Christianity seem to distinguish between licit chance-producing devices, which enable the religious community to determine the otherwise unknown will of God, and illicit chance-producing devices, which are used to transfer property among gamblers according to an unknown, mysterious logic. So as we shall see, Christianity also gave rise to some experiments of using chance-producing devices in order to encourage praying. And this is the third relation between gambling and praying. Gambling as praying. In Christianity, there were some experiments at using the activity of gambling as a sort of praying itself. And that was possible also because many religious cultures, including the Christian one, express a need for the accountability of praying, which was also monetized in certain period of Christian history, hence Luther's condemnation. Probably you remember, or you might think of, the most famous Catholic device for counting prayers, which is of course the rosary. It was invented in the 16th century exactly with this this purpose. So Christianity held a diversified attitude toward gaming involving chance, betting, and gambling. On the one hand, it radically condemned it. On the other hand, it radically condemned gambling but absorbed the chance gaming under certain circumstances. And there were also some, let's say, minority positions condoning gambling too under certain circumstances. Christian literature on the topic is abundant, starting from the early fathers of the church, such as Tertullian, Cyprian, or rather pseudo-Cyprian, Eusebius, to present-day theologians. Arguments that condemn gambling as a non-Christian activity are effectively summarized again by Charles 1924. Gambling, according to Christianity, is to be condemned on the following grounds. First, property can be legitimately transferred either by gift or by exchange of labor. Second, the very desire to get hold of unearned gains is in itself immoral. Third, gambling ruins the personality of man. Fourth, gambling leads to superstition. And fifth, no single good effect can be traced to gambling. However, as you may realize, all these arguments are moral arguments and are not properly theological arguments. Even those who condemn gambling must admit that from the strictly theological point of view, it is very difficult to condemn gambling within Christian theology. There is, of course, a deeper reason for condemning gambling in Christianity, that the Christian religion itself denies that there is such a thing as chance. There is no chance in Christian theology. So, at the same time, there are some arguments that are considered also by modern Christian theologians palliating or actually even justifying gambling. First of all, owing to the mechanical drudgery and monotony of most lives, gambling is justifiable as a necessary relief and diversion. This is a position that goes back to Thomas Aquinas and Summa Theologiae. Second, gambling is a legitimate recreation so long as the stakes are a matter of indifference to the players. Third, since gambling forms an element in commercial speculation, there can be no just objection to its forming an element in games and sport. And fourth, an interesting argument is that insurance is in reality a form of gambling. And hence, since few people would call insurance an immoral procedure, it is quite unjustifiable, it is contended, to brand gambling as such. And some Christian theologians also point to the fact that the Church itself, especially the Catholic Church, but also Protestant denominations, often resort to gambling in order to, for instance, finance some activities, some charities, for instance. So the prevailing attitude after the Christian Fathers of medieval Christianity towards gaming and particularly towards gambling was indeed disparaging, often referring to the early writings on the topic by the Fathers of the Church, especially the so-called mendicant orders, were generally against any kind of game. So gambling, gaming, no distinction. Saint Bernardino of Siena would condemn them, all games, with a vehemence that reminds one of present-day fundamentalists. It's very interesting in the history of religions that it is quite common for religious fundamentalists of all denominations to forbid games. So there is a strong relation between developing a fundamentalist version of religion and forbidding games. In Spectacular Bonfires, Saint Bernardino of Siena would burn not only the so-called female vanities, but also instruments of gaming, such as chessboards, checkerboards, and above all, cards, which were the new obsession of early 15th century players, for cards were increasingly diffused thanks to innovation in printing techniques. During Lent of 1424, in particular, the Senese preacher pronounced a violent sermon entitled Del peccato del gioco, on the sin of gaming, in which he declared that play cards are like multicolored copes. There are swords to cut you into pieces, claps to beat you up, coins for avarice, caps for drinkers, and the inebriation and the gluttony and the luxury in which gaming results. There is a famous painting that I cannot show to you by an anonymous artist executed at the end of the 15th century that shows, spectacularly shows, one of these bonfires. However, the more one focuses on early modernity, so moving from the Fathers of the Church to the Middle Ages toward early modernity, the more one finds exceptions in, for instance, literature such as confession handbooks. Martin Azpilicueta, an author cherished by the Casuists and considered as the forerunner of classical economics, as well as perhaps not fortuitously champion of the theological legitimacy of interest loans, wrote in his Manual de Confessores y Penitentes, Handbook of Confessors and Penitents, published in Coimbra in 1553, that, I quote, "Without committing a sin, the clergyman and the friar can sometimes play, even with dice and cards, for reasonable purposes, such as reawakening or cheering up an ill companion who would need such recreation," end of quote. In any case, attempts at moralizing games are not uncommon in the history of Christianity. The historical archives of the city of Colonia, Cologne in Germany, contain a manuscript in Rhenish Franconian entitled Ein Suerlich Buch von Bedeutung des Kätzchens, literally a ponderous book on the meaning of tennis. That is a translation completed in 1450 by a member of the Order of the Holy Cross, of the famous Flemish text Dat Ketzel Gemoralisiert, 1431, a moralized tennis, wherein the bailiff of Ferns would turn tennis into an allegory of fair justice. The problem at stake, indeed, was not the game, gaming itself, but gambling. A moralizing game was relatively easy. Moralizing, according to the Christian theological perspective, gambling was much more difficult. But there were some attempts at moralizing what the game theorist Roger Caillois would call alia, that is, chance. Among the different categories and typologies of game, it was exactly alia, chance games, that would steer the hostility of Christianity. For instance, as I mentioned to you before, already in the 3rd century, a homily by the pseudo-Cyprian entitled De Aleatoribus is explicit about the matter. Those who gamble forestall the advent of grace. Nevertheless, also gambling games, and not only agonistic games, have gave rise to attempts at Christian moralization. Already in the 10th century, Wibold, the Bishop of Cambrai, invented a ludus regularis seu clericalis, licit or clerical game, in which the dice's 56 possible numeric combinations were associated to a list of 56 virtues. Moralization of chance did not necessarily entail the invention of a new game, like in the case that I've just mentioned, but often consisted in the Christian interpretation of already existent games. That would concern also complete information games, such as chess, for instance, whose playing would, however, sometimes involve gambling and the use of dice. In the Laude Nonove Militiae, praise for the new militia, Bernard of Clairvaux had been peremptory, detestantur alias et scaccos, chance games and chess are to be despised. Nevertheless, around 1300, Jacopo de Cessole, a native of Asti, Italy, very close to where I'm from, Turin, and among the founders of the Dominican monastery of Savona, wrote the Ludus Scaccorum, the game of chess, or Liber de Moribus Hominum et Officiis Nobilium, etc., etc., a book on the customs of men and about the noble and more popular practices concerning chess. A collection of sermons, this work is comprised of 4 treatises. The first links the invention of game with a mythical pedagogy. The Persian philosopher Xerxes would have invented chess so as to encourage the irascible king Evagmerodach to pay patience. The second and the third treatises describe the virtues of the various chess pieces divided into noble and popular ones. And fourth treatise turns the chessboard into a metaphor of the city and recommends relations and actions of the various pieces, providing 100 exempla. So the Ludus Scaccorum gained enormous international success and was often also diffused together with lavish illustrations. In 1432, following the example of Jacopo de Cessole, which I've just mentioned, the Dominican Ingold von Basel, chaplain and reader of theology in Strasbourg, wrote the Büchlein von Guldenspiel, literally the booklet of the Golden Game. In it, he would deal with the origin, the modalities, the dangers, and the possible virtuous usages of 7 games: chess, board games with little discs, brettspiel, dice games, card games, archery or other similar games, dances, musical games, that is, the Saitenspiel, the playing string instruments. Of course, he refers to the semantic field of playing in German, which is a little bit like in English. So spielen is both playing an instrument and playing like a gaming device. Ingold would indeed propose an articulation based on the semantics of medieval German. The most interesting aspect of this treatise, however, lies in the fact that Ingold proposes a pseudo-reconstruction of the noble origin of each kind of game. Therefore, chess would have been invented by ancient and pagan sages such as Xerxes or Philomedes of Chaldea. Board games would have been invented by Greeks in front of Troy, etc., etc. And these imaginary etymologies of games, reconstructions, pseudo-historical reconstructions, were instrumental to propose the seven games as remedies to the seven capital sins. So each of the game was supposed to be a remedy against each of the capital sins. I could mention other attempts at the Christian moralization of gaming and gambling, the Viribus Quantitatis by Luca Pacioli, written between 1499 and 1509, that tried to use chess as an instrument to teach mathematics, but also to teach morality attached to mathematics. Liber de Ludo Ale by Geronimo Cardano, 1560, then published in 1663. But the main theological reference for all these attempts at moralizing gaming and sometimes also gambling was, of course, the passage in the Secunda Secunda in Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, where the most important medieval Christian theologian wrote, "Ludus est necessarius ad conversationem humanae vitae." Playing is necessary for the conversation of human life. So, indeed, playing and games for Thomas Aquinas were not only licit, but were also necessary as long as three criteria were respected. The first one was that the pleasure of the soul was not to be looked for in acts or in words harmful or undane of Christian believer. The second criterion was that the soul should never completely abandon its gravity. So even in playing the roulette in Las Vegas, one should retain a little bit of the gravity of the Christian soul. And the third is that the entertainment should be adapted, should be suitable for the people, for the times, for the place, and all the other circumstances. So one cannot, for instance, play at a funeral or in circumstances that are incredibly painful. One should play with different games and in different ways according to the circumstances. Those who in playing and also in gambling respect these three conditions achieve the virtue that Thomas Aquinas considers as the most important in playing. It is a virtue that Aristotle had already singled out in the Nicomachea Ethics, going under the name, Greek name, of eutrapelia. Eutrapelia. Etymologically, eutrapelia is the virtue of being apt, being able to effectively turn into joke acts and words. So this is a virtue that was considered very important by Aristotle for urban life and for life in society. In order to correctly live in society, according to Aristotle, one should possess this virtue of eutrapelia, so the ability to turn serious things into their ironic counterparts. And what is exactly the content of this eutrapelia is then specified by Dante, who, as you know, very often refers to Thomas Aquinas, but also to Aristotle through Thomas Aquinas. In the fourth book of the Convivio, Dante writes, "The tenth virtue has been called eutrapelia, which moderates, as in jokes, those that we appropriately make. This virtue, indeed, which the Romans would call iocunditas, comitas, or even better, urbanitas, consists in the capacity of living together and in the being able of enjoying appropriately the pleasure of being with others, giving in exchange to others, and a cordial and loving attitude. So this is, I think, the zest that we can extract from this very brief exploration of the Christian theology and the history of Christian theological ideas concerning gaming and gambling. Gambling remains something that is complicated, that is difficult to harmonize with the system of Christian theological ideas. Nevertheless, gaming is absolutely central and is actually one of the pillars of being able to appropriately live in society. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, do we have any questions?
I'm interested in the theological problem of grace. And in my studies of this very complex theological issue that is actually the object of a dogma in the Catholic theology, because you either choose a theological position in which God determines your spiritual fate, or you preserve the idea of the free will, and so you have to subtract some, let's say, power to the grace of God. And of course, there is a big difference between Protestant and Catholic theology concerning exactly this point, but even within Protestant theology and within Catholic theology, there are several positions. So the problem, the theological problem of grace, led me to study theological ideas about chance in Christianity. And many of these theological ideas were explored also with reference to the, let's say, most spectacular presence of chance in society, which is, of course, often gambling.
So what direction do you see your future research taking?
Thank you for this question. Thank you also for the previous question. That was very interesting. I was exploring your wonderful collections these days, and I was concentrating especially on the materials that are difficult to find elsewhere. And I was reading, in the short time at my disposal, some biographies of converted gamblers, which are extremely interesting to me. For instance, a classic is Steve P. Holcomb, The Converted Gambler. He was a gambler who then created a mission in order to convert other gamblers. And this topic is interesting to me because you see the construction of a sort of a hagiographical corpus in which you have this like moral discourse and gambling through this practice, this very old of exemplification and lives of gamblers, converted gamblers. And so Christian apologetics about gambling is what interests me a lot.
Very interesting. And if you would like more information about anything in our collection or the Center for Gaming Research itself, you can go to our website at gaming.unlv.edu. Thank you all very much for being here today.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of UNLV, its staff, faculty, alumni, or benefactors. For more information, please visit us at gaming.unlv.edu.